Okay, well, judging by the questions in the coffee time, I think people were more engaged by what I was saying in the Q&A than they were by what I was saying in the address. So what I'm going to do this time is make the address a bit shorter and make the Q&A a bit longer, so that we get a chance to dialogue a bit. But I want to focus down now on... HeartEdge talks about the four C's, and I did refer to these earlier. That's to say what we call culture, compassion, commerce, and congregational life. And we see the first three as, if you like, windows into the church, but also ways in which the church can discover the kingdom that lies beyond its own internal life. So I'm going to talk about one of those, the commercial part, today. I guess because I'm assuming, compared to the others, many, perhaps most of you, have got a lot of exposure to commercial life in your Monday to Friday lives, but probably very few of you got much exposure to commercial life in your Sunday life, if you like, and that's where the biggest disjunction lies. So I'm going to address three questions. The first one is there something inherently problematic in church getting too tangled up in business? Surely there must be a good reason why it isn't very common, and perhaps that reason lies in some deep-lying incompatibility identified in the Bible but easily overlooked. Second, if there is such a thing as the business of the kingdom, what kind of business might that involve, and what are its purposes? Third, what is the potential for a kingdom business movement within the vision of church renewal that I've been describing? Okay, so we'll start with the first question. Do we have a problem? In the United Kingdom, the biggest conceptual issue to overcome in understanding how church and business can coincide is a struggle to disentangle three things that easily get confused. First is the popular image of church amongst insiders and outsiders, a cheerful one of a sleepy vicar, a part-time secretary, and a working party every few months to dig out the churchyard and clear the gutters. This dovetails with the widespread notion of Christianity as otherworldly, absent-minded, harmless, and homespun, as found in the Vicar of Dibley. By contrast, the second is an image of business as a tight ship, a culture of money and success, and the power, influence, and often ruthlessness that come with them. For a lot of people, such things are always suspicious and usually bad, and a church is an easier place to relate to when it's hand-to-mouth, happy-go-lucky, and less than transparent about how it pays the bills. There's a lingering memory that Jesus drove money changers out of the temple, and for some this invalidates commercial activity altogether, but most people realize he was condemning the exploitation of the poor and the instrumentalization of religion for profiteering, rather than discrediting business itself. After all, his family were carpenters. And the third element that gets tangled up is the fear that if church gets too mixed up with business, the culture of business may obscure or even displace what has historically been the heart of what is meant by church, a living, worshipping, witnessing Christian community. It's this last element, the sense that business is all very well but is somehow not really church, that the key anxiety resides. Consider the word business. It's obviously derived from busyness, the state of being frenetic, occupied, all over busy. Here we have to acknowledge a philosophical and class-based distinction that goes back to classical times. In Latin, the word otium means leisure. The word for business is negotium, which means not leisure. For the ancients, the contemplative life was the highest aspiration. When Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living, he placed in the imagination of the West the idea that busyness was not only undesirable, but unworthy. This can play into a dualism that's found in a lot of Christianity, a dualism that drives a wedge between the worldly body and the otherworldly soul, and assumes spirituality is about escaping from the flesh and seeking the spirit. The incarnation and bodily resurrection of Jesus discredit this kind of dualism, because they show that God in Christ is utterly invested in our physical being, and that our life with God forever will be a physical, tangible one. The Bible addresses that dualism in different ways. The account of the capable wife in Proverbs 31 dismantles any sentimentality about a precious, trophy-leisured existence and praises the woman who rolls up her sleeves and plants and reaps and wheels and deals and acquires wisdom, strength, and dignity. The parable of the talents in Matthew 25 criticizes the slave who thought all that the master wanted was his intangible love, and praises the slaves who got into the marketplace and made that love real and took risks and found rewards. George Herbert's hymn, "Teach Me My God and King," is a similar prayer to find joy in daily tasks and turn business into ministry by placing it in the hands of God. A healthy society is not one that relegates work and business to the secondary outhouse of trade while exalting worship and prayer at the top table of piety. Instead, a healthy life seeks a rhythm of work, home life, nurture, rest, witness, service, and play, looking to worship, formation, personal devotion, and fellowship to inform and transform at every stage. Business requires imagination, commitment, competitiveness, alertness, care, skill, teamwork, wisdom, timing, energy, partnership, leadership, loyalty, and drive. These are all good, created, blessed, and worthy things, goods in themselves, and not just a means to the end of profit and making a living. If one had £1 million, one could give it away to a charity, but it might be better to set up or develop a business that gave livelihood, companionship, and flourishing life to a whole network of people while generating taxes for government and offering dignity to a community. So that's for those of you who've got £1 million, just for you to go away and think about. What kind of business? That's the second question. I'm going to suggest there are broadly three kinds of businesses available to congregations that wish to pursue commercial engagement. So the first one is what I call instrumental. That's to say, you undertake a legitimate trading activity that has no direct social impact, you make a profit, and then transfer that profit to other activities that do have a direct social impact, whether simply the sustainability of the congregation and its building, or such mission projects as it pursues. So that's number one, the instrumental. Number two is what I call the exemplary. You undertake a trading activity that has no direct social impact, but seek to do so in an exemplary way, paying good wages, having a minimal environmental footprint, using locally generated resources, promoting fair trade practices, and so on, while still transferring profit to the activities mentioned under the first category, the instrumental above. And then number three, social. You undertake a trading activity whose profit return is evidently secondary to the indirect social impact sought. So let's have a closer look at those three options. In the instrumental approach, the aim is simply to generate funds. Funds that in some congregations might be supplied by congregational stewardship or conventional voluntary fundraising, such as the parish fete or dinner and auction. A congregation might embark on such an enterprise if it had a building that had very high upkeep costs, for example, a listed building or one in a poor state of repair, or if the congregation had ambitions to purchase a building or increase the size and/or broaden the use of their building. There is no social impact foreseen in the activity itself. Any legitimate business proposition can suffice. Offering employment may be one among the ancillary social benefits, but such benefits are incidental to the central purpose of generating a profit. And that distinction is accentuated if the business is subcontracted to a third party and the staff members are not directly employed by the congregation or its commercial subsidiary. It's accentuated further if staff members of operating methods of the enterprise differ in significant ways from the ethos of the congregation. I've already referred to this, but it's not hard, for example, to see a clash of views about the sale of alcohol, if that were to be a primary form of income generation, or the appearance of books by new atheists if a bookstore were to be part of the business. When a congregation embarks on such an enterprise, it makes two assumptions. One is that the venture will indeed make a profit. The other is that the profit will indeed be used to achieve the ministry or mission objectives envisaged, rather than, for example, be drawn upon to underwrite or invest in the business. In broad terms, this approach is similar to the way a regular business disburses a proportion of its profit through its corporate social responsibility budget, how a foundation invests its endowment in financial markets, or how charities develop trading subsidiaries. Thus, the National Trust runs a large number of gift shops. In the exemplary approach, many of the same principles apply. The difference is that the congregation sees the enterprise not just as a cash cow to fund its mission, ministry and mission, but as part of, and in some cases integral to, its ministry and mission. For that reason, it accepts a lower financial return because it regards some of what would have been profit as expenditure on ministry and mission. For example, if it maintains a policy of paying an optional local minimum wage, or assigning more than statutory sick pay, or giving its staff other such benefits, it is setting the costs of being an exemplary employer against other ministry and mission projects that could have been funded with the same money. This leaves aside the argument that paying better wages makes for happier staff and consequently increased profits, and also the PR value and thus potential financial benefit of being known as a good employer. To make this step is to challenge the conventional understanding of church in a way the first approach need not. For example, can it still be described as mission and ministry if many or most of the people employed by the business aren't Christians? To ask this question minimizes the power of the Holy Spirit. The Christian story is full of examples of how the Holy Spirit inspires people to further the kingdom beyond the imagination of the church. It wouldn't cross many Christians' minds to suggest that Christian Aid isn't doing mission, even though most people who work for Christian Aid worldwide aren't Christians. Having an open recruitment policy invites into the community a wondrously diverse, extraordinarily committed, and endlessly fascinating body of people whose humility, hard work, and integrity may well put the rest of the community to shame. The mistake is to concentrate on what perhaps isn't there instead of seeing what abundantly is there. An opportunity could be missed to create a living example of creative and dynamic unity and diversity without uniformity or exclusion, exactly what the United Kingdom's multicultural society as a whole is striving for. In the social approach, the third approach, the company has the appearance of a business, but the primary goal is to model the kingdom by prioritizing social means as well as social ends. Thus, the business may make a priority of employing people with disabilities, for example, a carpentry workshop, where those with a developmental disability can flourish doing relatively limited repetitive tasks. Alternatively, a venture may seek to train prisoners for work after their period of incarceration, perhaps as a chef or table attendant in a restaurant. For a congregation, this is simply mission. It doesn't need and can seldom aspire to be income generating to any significant degree, but its metrics are not those of a conventional profit and loss account. The most challenging thing for a congregation can be to be clear in its expectations. It's not helpful to set up a business directed at raising profits, to hire staff equipped to do that, and to market the venture accordingly, only for congregation members to lament that the business does not look like it's taking the social approach, when that was never the intention. The problem is not the sordidness of all commercial enterprise, it's about a failure to give clear instructions and set realistic expectations. A subset of the social approach we might call the balanced approach. In the balanced approach, there is no separation between the financial profits and the social impact. The two are of a piece. In many cases, the company has to find a balance between generating financial returns and creating social impact. Examples include fair trade businesses and microfinance institutions. In such cases, the need to show a significant profit inevitably lessens the social benefit, at least in the short to medium term. A relatively unusual variant of this model is found where the financial returns and the social impact match each other. Examples include wind farms and organic vegetable box schemes. These are in many ways ideal social enterprises because they both make a profit and have a significant social benefit. And the more benefit they generate, the more profit they make. One can imagine a clothing firm that pioneers the use of organic cotton, making a trade-off between financial and social returns. The firm could use non-organic cotton, which would be cheaper but less environmentally friendly. Non-organic cotton crops represent one of the heaviest uses of pesticides in the world. Suppose, however, that the market eventually changes so that consumers end up preferring to buy only organic cotton clothing and are prepared to pay much more for it. In such a scenario, an ethical clothing firm continues to use organic cotton and should make money by doing so. In purely financial terms, much the same things could be said of a congregation. The larger it gets, and in particular the more congregational giving it generates, the more it can do by way of ministry and mission. This is a crude form of measurement, but it's nonetheless the spoken or unspoken aspiration of most congregations. Having surveyed three kinds of business and given examples of how they work in society and in the church, it's time for a brief review of which kind might be suitable for a congregation to adopt. The answer largely lies in the reasons that brought the congregation into this conversation in the first place. A congregation that's broadly happy with its vision for ministry and mission, but finds it simply can't pay for the activity it feels called to sustain, is likely to go for the instrumental approach. A number of decisions will characterize what kind of business and thus what relation to ministry and mission is in view. Will the business take place on the same site as the church building? If not, it's easier to distinguish between the business and the congregation. Indeed, it might be hard to make any connection at all, which might be a deliberate policy. For example, the congregation may come to own one or more properties that are rented out at a profit, or a share portfolio that's traded for significant returns. These are ways of keeping income streams largely invisible. By contrast, a church in a marketplace may sell land or property and build or convert a space into a cafe for use by the public. If such a cafe is sublet, the instrumental imperative is highlighted, and the congregation's leadership will need to keep a very close relationship with those running the cafe in order to anticipate, avoid, and downplay any tensions of ethos or operation. If the cafe is run by the congregation or its trading subsidiary, it will almost inevitably need to migrate to the exemplary approach, since the staff will quickly and widely be regarded as representatives of the congregation, whether they see themselves that way or not. There are good reasons why a congregation may wish to maintain an instrumental approach. If its ministry and mission are exemplary in every respect, other than its ability to pay for them, it may choose to keep the large majority of its focus on its areas of strength. If its congregational capacity is small and it doesn't see itself being able to cope with the management, governance, and leadership requirements of employing a significant number of people, it may be wise not to do so. If the business conducted is a specialist one and not widely understood, it may be best to subcontract it and leave it to the experts. However, in most cases, especially when the business and the congregation share premises, the instrumental approach will be a temporary status, perhaps for the first few years, while the enterprise becomes established, and the congregation's aspiration will be to integrate the business more fully with the life of the whole congregate organization, which is what the exemplary approach seeks to do. The exemplary approach is subject to many challenges. If a business seeks to pay its staff the living wage and is in a sector where that is rare, it is putting itself at a commercial disadvantage against its competitors. If a venture is to adapt itself to market conditions, be ahead of the curve in its products and marketing, bring out the best in its staff, and have a dynamic plan for 5 years hence, it will need excellent senior management and talented non-executive directors. This will almost certainly entail attracting people of suitable background and ability from the wider church and community, who, in the case of the directors, expect no reward but the pride of being part of a worthy cause, or in the case of the executives, could doubtless earn a higher salary elsewhere. If the marketing is unattractive, the product not good enough, the commercial climate challenging, or the whole concept flawed, the profit may be small or non-existent. People will be heard to say, "This is not a charity," when actually in some ways it is. While painful choices may need to be faced about those things that make up the term exemplary, and which ones need to be sacrificed first. There's no doubt people will be quick to point out the hubris of calling oneself exemplary, ignoring the difference between a fact and an aspiration. Even if it goes well, it can, like any aspect of ministry or mission, become an idol, absorbing all of some people's energies to the detriment of their well-being or the wide calling of the congregation. Notwithstanding these hazards, the exemplary approach is the best fit for most congregational commercial ventures. Like it or not, everything a congregation does is part of its witness. If it treats commercial activity in an instrumental way, It's sending a message about how it regards business, staff, and profit. Such a message is at best dualist because it sees spiritual endeavor as superior to material, and at worst cynical because it's using people's labor, or even demeaning because it's regarding the work of some as of less account than the efforts of others. So the congregation will almost inevitably find itself moving toward the exemplary model, enthusiastically or reluctantly. But if it embraces the exemplary approach, and it has the capacity to oversee such a venture, the rewards are much more than just financial. Many congregations cultivate an attitude of studious observation, priding themselves on protest, advocacy, and calling on who knows who to change who knows what. But a successful and exemplary business makes it possible to seek more than that. It creates the opportunity to do several things most churches can't dream of doing. Where many are content to survive, such a congregation can thrive and model what a healthy, sustainable, just, ecological organization might look like in its relations with God, one another, and the created world, in its pattern of work and ministry and mission, prayer and play. If it flourishes, others may invite it to come alongside them and inspire them to combine commerce with congregational life. It can be part of reinvigorating the wider church from a disempowered state of complaint, resentment, impoverishment, and lament to a vibrant condition of action, confidence, generosity, and healthy pride. Just as within every congregation, there are voices skeptical about the faithfulness of ministry expenditure and demanding all resources be put towards mission, so in every congregational business, similar voices will regard exemplary business as inadequate unless it adopts what I've called the social approach. The social approach wants every employee to be an ex-offender or formerly homeless or multiply disabled, wants every raw material to be locally sourced, and wants all wages and benefits to be the best in the sector. Advocates of the social approach long for the day when a stranger might wander in and see the activity of the business in its different dimensions, and its integration with the regular ministry of the congregation in worship, fellowship, education, and pastoral care, and ask, this kingdom you speak of, this communion, this turning of society into community, this freedom and flourishing beyond market and state, this company of grace, what does it look like? And those advocates could then turn round and sweep their hand over every aspect of the community's life together and say gently but truly, it looks like this. It goes without saying that the more the exemplary approach looks and feels like the social approach, the better in almost every way. But an honest conversation needs to be had about the principal aim of the enterprise. If the intention is to fund a mission of which the congregation is already rightly proud, which is flourishing in every way besides mustering sufficient funds, then there's nothing to apologize for in the exemplary approach. If, however, there is no such flourishing mission, and or if there is no significant imperative to raise funds to sustain it, then the social approach may become that outstanding ideal form of mission. But the important recognition is that the social approach is mission, wholly or largely evaluated by its positive impact on those beyond the congregation, whereas the exemplary approach is better thought of as ministry, building up the congregation and making it more fit for mission. It's not that the exemplary approach is an inadequate or too worldly version of the social approach. They are different things designed for different ends. In the first, the profit is primary, the impact secondary. In the second, the impact is primary, the profit secondary. There can be excellent examples of both, but they are very seldom, if ever, successfully combined in the same project. And this is where the balanced approach comes in as a variant of the social approach. As I've pointed out, most organisations find it next to impossible to make a genuine profit at the same time as making space to broaden their hiring policies and prioritise training and support for vulnerable employment groups. But before that sounds like a lack of faith or aspiration, it's helpful to recognise that harmonising such divergent goals is exactly what the congregation seeks to do in its ministry life all the time. Congregations invite those with disabilities to read a lesson in worship, or preside at Holy Communion, and invest in lapel microphones or flexible liturgical furniture as appropriate to accommodate various needs. Congregations ask a person with a conviction for fraud to lead a working party tidying the churchyard. They take for granted that a person who has little or no money to contribute to the collection is nonetheless an equal and honoured member of the flock and can attend the parish away weekend without paying the full cost. It's precisely to maintain these kinds of practices, which some might call radical but congregations come to assume are normal, that instrumental or exemplary enterprises are set up in the first place. The best role of a business is to support an already dynamic ministry and mission, not to substitute for one that is not already there. So I'm going to now to talk a little bit about kingdom business. I haven't discussed the secrets of what makes a profitable business, on which the available literature is vast, or which types of goods or services make the best fit for congregations to develop, which is a matter for local expertise, research and judgment. Instead, I want to return to the attitudes of the parable of the shrewd manager and learn from its lessons that generosity is the best investment, happiness lies in learning to love the things God gives in plenty, and business is primarily a matter of making friends. How does a congregation strike the right balance and foster business that celebrates and announces the kingdom rather than one that obscures or diminishes the kingdom? I'm going to suggest four avenues of inquiry that a congregation might pursue as it seeks to evaluate whether to proceed with a commercial venture and whether to continue with one in its existing form or to change it wholly or partly. The first is to have a clear answer to the question, what counts as success? Assuming we're talking about an exemplary business, the second approach I've just described, the criteria must be sufficiently narrow to be achievable, yet adequately broad to be worth achieving. They must include generating enough profit to sustain the ministry and mission of the church in such respects as existing forms of income, such as congregational giving, are insufficient. But they may also include questions such as, is this enterprise bringing a whole new range of people into face-to-face relationship with the church and leaving them with positive impressions and experiences? Is the process of employment enriching the congregation by rubbing shoulders with people who are happy to work for a church but would previously have been unlikely ever to attend one? Are we together unobtrusively changing the whole notion of church if we are celebrating the ministry of the Muslim finance head or the Jewish HR manager, and setting their contribution alongside the church treasurer or the occasional attender at the midweek service? Such questions go way beyond asking if this church is now able to pay its bills. They recognize that a commercial enterprise has the potential to revolutionize a congregation for good. The polarization between the hard-nosed business success and sentimental failure is exposed as a false one. A commercial venture will inevitably involve, affect, and benefit more people than originally envisaged. To establish such a project is to take a step of faith that those encounters will be beneficial ones. Which takes us into the second area of inquiry. Does the church really believe it is called to an incarnate ministry, addressing the pragmatics of earning a living, sustaining employment, addressing pensions and sick benefits, transacting monetary exchanges, and making difficult decisions that can disappoint some and even hurt others? Jesus was a carpenter's son. Paul was a tent maker. Even the central figures of the Christian faith had to experience the reality of making money to live on, and presumably they found a way to make the practice a blessing. It may be helpful to recognize that conventional congregational stewardship is in practice an instrumental approach. The church takes no responsibility for how the money donated has originally been raised. Whether by fraud or extortion or stealing or sharp practice or wholesome, non-exploitative, honest wage for honest work. Is not congregational enterprise in full public view more likely to be the way of integrity? Is not a scheme like this, in which a whole array of members can take appropriate roles, potentially an opportunity to witness like never before? Here is an example of how the challenges of discipleship and daily life may be understood, pondered, and engaged. It is a living statement that salvation is not an escape from worldly reality, but living God's future in the midst of present circumstances. Such an enterprise can be a living sacrament of hope in such a way. This opens a third area of exploration. Is the business making the congregation more honest or less? There's no doubt that professionalism and success take a bit of getting used to in a country that has seldom been in the habit of associating such terms with the word church. there's a way in which professionalism and success can keep a congregation honest, because they dismantle the myth that the church lives on air, and they require and inspire everyone to maintain strong organizational standards about everything they do. But there's also a way in which commercial profits can keep a congregation dishonest, because they can make it possible to have a flourishing church life without the congregation paying all the bills, which is a luxury few churches can comprehend. Nonetheless, it's possible to have commercial activities and administrative practices that deepen and embody a congregation's understanding of the kingdom, rather than conflict with or confuse it. Business brings into a church's life, as customers and staff, a myriad of people who otherwise might not come near, and a diversity of identity that's dynamic and energizing. By serving people and creating a staff team, a congregation learns what love and justice and flourishing mean when translated into economic decisions and regular habits of trade and employment. If the church wants to pay good wages, it has to make sacrifices elsewhere. If it wants to sell fair trade lines, it has to ensure they're attractive. If it wants to give disadvantaged people a step on the employment ladder, it needs to give them appropriate support. It's seldom easy, but the rewards go far beyond financial stability. Finally, comes the question that absorbs all the other questions. Is this what the kingdom looks like? Well, for a truly holistic account, daily encounter with the incarnate reality of how people live and sustain their lives, and collective endeavor to keep a community going, not with dramatic gifts, but with careful, humble acts of common purpose, is a beautiful yet pragmatic encounter with graft and grace. It may not be necessary, possible, or desirable for every congregation, but it could be the single most dynamic step in revitalizing the church for a future that's bigger than the past. Okay, that was a lot about business. But what I want you to see is just the depth of the kind of questions you have to ask yourself if you're going to go into this, for me, incredibly refreshing, undoubtedly demanding, and certainly novel understanding of how we renew the church. We're going to do what we did last time, have a quick chat to somebody close by, and then Andy's going to run around with the microphone for the last sort of 20, 25 minutes or so.
I'm struggling to find a question, but how do you inspire that imagination? How does the penny drop?
I can give two answers to that. The real answer is about people believing that they are the children of God, that we are the early church. We're only 2,000 years into this. There isn't a set way of doing it. We're still setting the rules. We've got millions of years to go here. This is very early days. You know, there is a tendency, I think, in every generation of the church to think we're kind of coming near the end of this, either because the second coming is coming or because the church is more or less moribund and there won't be a church in the next couple of generations. You know, either of those are ways of, they're different forms of eschatology in a way. They're different ways of bringing things to an end. I always say that the second coming will come in one of two ways. Way one is when everyone on earth is a Christian and the church has done its job. There's nothing more for it to do. Or when there are no Christians left on earth, and then the second coming will come to restore and to enliven and so on. So it is part of a general question. So I mean, I'll just quickly tell you the most enlivening exercise I've ever done with a congregation, and it's quite simply shortly explained. I've only ever done it in a group of 8 or 10 people in a sort of house group type setting. So the first thing is you draw four columns on a flip chart, and column one is what's your favourite part of the service? You know, funnily enough, very few people say the sermon, sadly, tragically. They're just protecting my pride, really. But sharing the peace or whatever it might be. And then column two is what does that really mean? You know, why do you like it? I remember a very Anglo-Catholic church where I did this exercise with them, and a bus driver said, doing the incense, you know, doing the thurible in a very, many of you have been in more Catholic services where they use a thurible. I've just been in South Africa where they use incense a lot in the church in South Africa. And he was the person that did it. So he said, I love it because it creates a sense of mystery. So that was his second column. The third column was, where else in the week do you find that second thing, sense of mystery? He said on the terraces at Newcastle United. And the fourth column is, and what does that tell you about God? Augustine says that God is an infinite circle whose centre is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. I mean, he was a bus driver, so he didn't use that language, but he was more or less saying that about his experience of using incense in the service, in a very Old Testament practice. And I find I did that in one congregation. I did that with almost a whole congregation in small groups. And they started off saying, well, I really like it because I like sharing the peace or I like serving the coffee. But by the end, they realized that they'd experienced revelation. And in a sense, ministry, I think, is encapsulated in that sort of exercise where what seems to be just walking around, shaking hands with the people you like and hugging the people you can get hold of and get one chance a week to get hold of, and turning that into an experience of the living God, a revelation of the face of God. So if people are getting towards the fourth column, then you're doing your job in ministry. It seems to me that they're taking, you know, that's what sacraments are, you know, ordinary earthly things that show us heavenly divine glory. A different way of doing it is travel. You know, travel broadens the mind. Let's go on a trip. Doesn't have to be to the Holy Land, it might be. Let's go on a trip to somewhere exotic like Liverpool. I don't know. I mean, you know, my choir have just been to South Africa on a trip and I've just accompanied them. So, you know, and what do you find in South Africa? You find people doing incredible work in the poorest slums in the country, helping young black girls find confidence and discover academic ability out of even the most unpropitious circumstances. And you find it inspiring, of course you do. And you come back to London and you think, why can't we do that? You know, and that can happen on any level. You go to Liverpool, and of course you're really going, to see Colchester play the big cup game at Anfield or something like that. But actually, while you're there, you happen to know a couple of clergy and a couple of people running social enterprises, and you think, why don't we pop in and see a couple of my mates? You know, just because we can't just, the 90 minutes of the match aren't the only reason we're going. And then you go and see that and you think, oh. And that's, you know, that's how churches receive charismatic renewal, because they go to that airport place in wherever it is in Toronto, or they go to Holy Trinity Brompton, or they go to some church that their cousin goes to, and they come back and say, well, we should do it like that here. Hey, you know, those people up there are just the same as us. Why, if they've got the Holy Spirit, we should jolly well have the Holy Spirit. I mean, you know, it's envy, it's example, it's very human things, but all of those stir the appetites, the desires, and say, we can be more than this. You know, because actually a lot of the churches in this country are clinging on to that stewardship model and are shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. You know, that's the pretext of everything that I've said tonight. And I suppose how you excite the imagination of congregation. I mean, the last thing I'd say about that is that St. Martin's is the easiest job I've ever done in ministry, because the hardest thing in ministry is to create energy. And that every single day I wake up, and there's a lot of people out there with a lot more energy than me. The whole community is surrounded by people coming saying, can we do this? Can we have this exhibition? Can we have this big service here? And you know, you find yourself saying no to fantastic things because you're saturated.
You can send them to Bellevue.
Yeah, I'll send them to Bellevue. I said, you know, there's a guy at Bellevue who's doing a great job, but he's got nothing to do. So why don't you go and talk to him? Whereas, you know, when I was working on a council estate in East Anglia, energy was really at a premium. And that was why it was such a hard job. There was, and you know, it's more or less the situation you're describing. In the imagination, you know, I always say that the key to life is confidence and imagination. Imagination is knowing what to do, and confidence is having people you trust to do it with. And they're two things you cannot manufacture. You can only generate, foster, create fertile soil for. You can have absolutely the right doctrinal everything, but if you haven't got confidence and imagination, you're really, really struggling. And so I'm just offering a couple of ways, you know, getting people to realize they have met God, and that's exciting, and then taking them to a place which is having more fun than they're having.
Just as I go, can I ask a quick question, which is, I wonder if the thing with business is we think this is something, you're telling us to do something new that the church has never done. And I wonder if actually we need to recover. Actually, the churches in the past have been very business. I've just read recently Paula Gooder's book, Phoebe, talking about the early church in Rome. And one of those is about these group of women who start an enterprise to make money, to make that church run and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a sort of Grameen Bank. Yeah, I mean, that's right. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Thank you for your presentation tonight. It's been incredibly helpful, and you've used the word imagination a number of times, and I was just thinking back to your response to the question before the break, and you gave a very broad response in terms of the church's mission and who we are called to be, which I loved. And I was just wondering, to use the word imagination again and Walter Brueggemann's prophetic imagination, who would you imagine the church to become or to be in the next 50 or 100 years, relating to being communities of peace and justice?
Well, I've got a friend called Andrew Shanks, who's a bit of an eccentric, but I did a bit of work with him and we've kept in touch off and on. He used to work at Manchester Cathedral. And he talks about the church as being a radically repentant ex-oppressor church. So for me, I think of peace as a sort of like a 12-stage recovery program, like Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe we're all addicted to violence. We're all recovering violent people. And that violence doesn't name all the ways in which we distort our relationships, but it's as good a single word as any. And therefore, we're all in a recovery program which, as a whole, we could call peace, of which I think the first six stages are more or less what you could call secular. You know, things like telling a truthful story, they would apply in, you know, post-apartheid South Africa or anywhere. And then the last six stages are what you might call theological Christian practices: repentance, confession, forgiveness, reconciliation, and then the last two are acts of God, healing and resurrection. And to be in one of those 12 stages is to be part of peace. You know, peace isn't a place we ever finally arrive at. I mean, we hope heaven, but in this life, we never get to that sort of cloudy, harp, pasty angel sort of place of a being above it all, you know, glorious sunsets the whole time. You know, we don't get that. That's just not life. And so the best we can, and actually what we tend to do as human beings is, because we find that path difficult, we turn away from places where we find it difficult and say life's too short or some profoundly untheological expression like that, and just go to places where it's easier. You know, the toddler group is an easier place to find reconciliation than in my own family Christmas dinner, for example. So I'm just not going to go to my family Christmas dinner. I'm going to think about it as little as possible, because my uncle is going to sit there. He's going to offer bigoted views that are uninformed, that I can't challenge without ruining Christmas for everybody, you know, that kind of thing. And so I'll work with the toddler group, because actually there are women there who are in second marriages who are finding, you know, a sense of peace after a turbulent 10 years of a difficult relationship that ended bad, you know, and they're talking about it because this new child represents new life for them, and, you know, that's much easier work than dealing with my uncle. So for me, by calling the last two stages of peace, healing and resurrection, I'm saying that peace is an inherently theological thing, and that actually peace and salvation are more or less the same thing, and that we're all permanently engaged in process of peace. And in fact, conversion, you know, becoming a Christian from having not been a Christian, coming to know Jesus as your Lord and Savior, whatever language you want to use around that, is a process of peace, because it's reconciliation with God. You know, it's what 2 Corinthians is all about. So that we should, you know, currently, you know, I'm going to say some sad things now, and I only get to say these as a visitor who's been asked a question like that towards the end of an evening. But what is the church thought of as by the general public under 35 or under 45? You know, bigoted, self-absorbed, clinging to an image of a society that most of the rest of the society isn't living. And I say to my very conservative friends, thanks for that. You know, because in my day, when I was growing up, we were a kind of irrelevant uncle who, you know, spoke a bit of wisdom and you got together with on significant occasions like Christmas and funerals, but the rest of the time was fairly irrelevant to your life. That's what I grew up with as the church. And now it's become actually a force, you know, a malign force in society as seen by most people. So that's the journey we've made. What a great journey that is. Thanks for that. Evangelism becomes so much easier in that social background. You know, we've chosen the wrong issues to make a fight about. That means we have to renounce the assumption that we chair the meeting, whether it's about social good, whether it's about ethics. You know, we've lost that right. We've lost that right because we've chosen the right wrong issues to fight about, and we've lost that right because of things like clerical sex abuse that have taken away a lot of our moral authority. However, because we are almost the only or one of the very few organisations in society that really talk about the purpose of human life rather than the mechanics of making life work. You know, the whole of the political debate is about putting enough money in people's pockets and enough discretionary power in people's lives, whether that's getting rid of Brussels or whether that's, you know, keeping taxes as low as possible to give people enough money to spend, that they'll be able to make their own choices. Nobody is talking about what constitutes a good choice. That's off the table politically and has been for 100 years. You know, Augustine says that in the fall we retain the ability to choose, but we lose the ability to make good choices. Well, all about politics is giving us choices. Nobody's talking about what constitutes good choices. It's, you know, it's we don't do God. You know, that's off the table politically. So, and so where in our public life does anyone have a conversation about it? But the churches are still talking about those things. So that's why they really matter. politically, because they're talking about what makes good choices. And their answers to those questions motivate people to give more voluntary hours of service than any other organisation in the country, food banks and, you know, goodness knows what else, handing out hymn books at the beginning of worship, welcoming team in the foyer here. So provided we're prepared to come back into that public conversation, knowing what we're talking about what is human life for, you know, that's what churches are basically talking about. Nobody else has got any good answers to those questions. That's why we need to be at the table, not just for our sake, but for everyone else's sake. But we can't chair the meeting anymore. We've lost the authority, we've lost the social standing. Well, we've all been in meetings where it didn't matter who the chair was, that provided somebody else provided good arguments, exemplified those arguments in their own life, and could point to communities that were living out those arguments in practice, they would win the conversation, because that's what you need to win the conversation. We can still do that. We're as well placed to do that as we ever were. What we can't do anymore is chair the meeting. You know, the established church won't last a whole lot longer, or it'll become so irrelevant that no one knows whether the church is established or not. You know, resting on that kind of thing, that's dinosaur territory. But continuing to live out communities of reconciliation where we can be small enough. I'm not really into massive churches. We can be small enough to recognise most of each other, to know the person that's just been through the painful divorce, actually quietly to know the household where there's domestic abuse, but it's just not the right time to make a big deal of it. You know, to know that the family that thought long and hard about the abortion in the end had the courage to have the multiply disabled child and to gather around that family and support them. You know, that's what church is. And you want people to walk into that environment and say, I can for the first time be honest about my life because I'm surrounded by people who are recoverers. You know, it's like walking into an Alcoholics Anonymous. I can say I'm an alcoholic. Here I can say I'm a sinner. I can say I fathered two illegitimate children before I was 25. I met Megan. We settled down. We've made a life together. And I recognise I made some mistakes in my past, and I treated those two women really badly. And I can actually now tell a select number of people and trust that, you know, those kind of communities. Where do you get that? But that's what we have, because we have the forgiveness of sins. We have the promise of eternal life. What a fantastic gift that is to our nation and to every single individual in it. And wouldn't anybody who was in the right state of mind walk into a community like that and say, this is what I've been spent all my life looking for? I think we've got as good a chance to be that as at any time in history. We've lost a lot of the social trappings, you know, numbers, money and social influence that I talked about before. We lost a lot of that, and now we can get on with being real church. So that's my vision for 50 years.
Have you been seeing the sort of people that have been involved, guys that aren't part of the Sunday community or home groups or, you know, the mm-hmm. church? Have you been seeing guys from the other elements, so social enterprise business, engaging then with the church? It'd be great to hear some stories. If so,
yeah. I mean, I think so. Okay, two kinds of stories that I'd give you. One is a member of our, well, two members of our Sunday International group. This is the Asylum Seekers group, who were, I would have thought, majority Muslim. They've come from India, they've come from parts of Africa. Some Christian, but, you know, two of the Muslim members who now, who do come to church, but what they most love is serving coffee. You know, it's a classic. I mean, I hinted about this in the comments about the welfare state a while ago. You've got to give, and it is partly gendered, particularly applies to men, but it applies to everybody, really. People want to be needed and be given work to do. It doesn't have to be paid work, but they want to feel. You know, just imagine I come in tonight, I wasn't the speaker, I didn't know anybody, because I'd come from a church somewhere else or something. And I'd come into this community, most people had come with somebody they knew, you know, they'd paired off, they'd talked about the gossip when since I last saw them. You feel very isolated, you feel like leaving. Unless, you know, Andy comes up to me and says, could you do the coffee? We're one short today. And then you say, thank you, hallelujah, I've got something to do, conversations start naturally over handing out the coffee. You know, so I mean, that's, you know, my philosophy of evangelism is give people jobs to do when they've only been there 5 minutes. And we've got, you know, we've had some wonderful success in that way. I think the other thing, another initiative that we've started at St. Martin's is called Great Sacred Music. We have a big music tradition. We had a service that the clergy were hanging on to because we have lunchtime concerts, free lunchtime concerts, 3 days a week. We have a choral Eucharist one day a week. And then we had this other day, a Thursday, which was become a real sacred cow because the clergy wouldn't let go of it because that was just giving up yet another prime slot to the concert department. And so they had this service that about 15 people were coming to. Now, you know, 15 people and a dog will come to anything at St. Martin in the Fields because they just wander in from Trafalgar Square and they don't know where they are. So getting 15 people to come to something is like getting zero in some ways. It wasn't working, but the clergy wouldn't let go of it because that seemed like such a failure. So after I've been there about a year, I had a chat with the director of music and said, why don't we create something that looks like a concert, but it turns out to be something a bit more like a worship service, a little bait and switch in some ways. It isn't a worship service. We don't light the candles. The singers don't put on robes. They just wear ordinary clothes. I don't say a prayer. We do sing hymns, but people sit down for the hymns as if they're just sort of singing along in a community spirit rather than worshiping. You know, so that we try and keep it right on the boundary between between concert and worship, so that some people come out and say thanks for the service, and some people say come out and say thanks for the concert. And that has been our principal evangelism tool, because we kind of try and pitch it at Classic FM. Why do people have a stressful day of work, come home, run a bubble bath, and switch on Classic FM? Because there's something about the music that's healing. Now, okay, so let's do two things. Let's give them that music live, which is twice the experience of hearing on the radio, and let's talk about what that precisely that thing that makes it so healing. You know, is it something about the composer? Is it something about the style of music? Is it a funny story about some combination of circumstances? Or is it something about the actual theology of what's going on in Handel's Messiah or Mozart's Requiem or whatever it is that actually is both interesting and moving at the same time? That has become our biggest outreach thing that's brought people into the regular congregation. Not always the Sunday congregation, because we have at least as many people who attend worship during the week as we do on a Sunday. But that's central London, you know. And the people that most move me that come to that are people who have been churchgoers and have been lapsed and then have come back. And, you know, those are probably the most fascinating people in our country for me, because tragically the reasons why they've left have been reasons that reflect terribly on the church. We tend to think people who stop coming to church are lazy or, you know, distracted or, you know, have adopted some different lifestyle that's in contradiction with the Christian faith or whatever. In my experience, most of them have had just awful experiences of church. So I'll just tell you one story. So I went to, some of you will know this story, I went to visit a woman on account of a previous job in a council estate because her daughter rang me up to say, please go and visit my mother. This woman was 93. She hadn't been to church since she was 18, but she wanted to see the vicar. I thought, this is interesting. And I said, well, can you tell me about why you stopped going to church? And she said, I was in Cardiff. I was working in a mill. I met a boy. I took my fiancé to see the local rector to ask to get married. He looked at my left hand, which looked like this, because she'd had three fingers taken off in a mill accident. He said, you haven't got a ring finger, so I can't marry you. And, you know, it's just so apocalyptically awful that you couldn't make a story like that up. It had to be true. I was surprised after 75 years she was prepared to give us another chance, frankly. But, you know, that she's the lapsed. Why is she lapsed? You know, because of the horror of what the church can be. You know, of mixing up prejudice and social class and standards and notions of disability with the gospel, which it contradicts all of those things. And, you know, those are the kind of people that come to Great Sacred Music and say things like, you've introduced me to a kinder Christianity. You know, I sang these songs in a choir when I was a boy and I haven't been to church since, and now for the first time I'm here and I'm coming back because I love this. You know, that kind of thing. So those are the rewards you get if you make the church as wide as the kingdom. You know, there's some challenges of doing that, but I'm not changing my policy. So those are a couple of stories. We've probably overshot, have we?
There is one more question, very quick.
We were just talking in our group earlier about the different ways of resourcing the church's activities and ministries, and you had mentioned the kind of early church and the fact that they came together and gave everything they had, pulled it together and looked after each other in that way. And so we were just wondering, why would you choose the sort of business model, the sort of social, that highest level of it,
mm-hmm.
that's very ethical and is bringing profits into the church and funding their ministries and their mission, over the kind of more radical living out this generosity where we're all just sharing everything we have and funding the activities that way? So are you, we weren't sure if you were going to touch back on giving more than the 10% and challenging us that way versus bringing in the business to fund what the church was doing.
Well, I mean, that's a big question. I mean, so if anyone here wants to join a radical Christian community that shares all it has and lives Acts 2, I'm going to be the last person to stop you. I think that's a beautiful way to live. I don't actually see a lot of the church in this country doing that. I'm trying to make a proposal from where we are, not from where we were in 35 AD. You know, even the most faithful believers in scriptural inerrancy will recognize that there's a slightly romantic view about that. And of course, Ananias and Sapphira come straight on the back of Acts 4. You know, Acts is full of controversy about the church. The idea that we all have everything common, everything's hunky-dory, and it's all crumbly candy bars and cupcakes, it doesn't come out of the Acts of the Apostles. Only a very select reading of Acts, the end of Acts 2 and the end of Acts 4 would justify that. The rest of Acts is like, you know. So, problem number one is that that's a slightly romanticized picture. Problem number two is that, you know, very few people are actually living it. But there are some other problems as well. So problem number three is that the Benedictines did it. They did become immensely wealthy. And then they became, in the Middle Ages, a huge discredit to the church because they had to, you know, they had so much wealth. And then another really interesting case is the Amish today, because the Amish, you know, in Pennsylvania notoriously don't have cars and don't have technology and are more or less sort of stuck in the 16th century in their clothing and everything. But because they practice more or less this model, they have become colossally wealthy, but they don't have any idea what to do with all their money. Because all the things that most people spend their money on are not outlets for Amish. And it's become a source of tremendous instability in the Amish community. It's not an ideal situation at all. They're almost cursed by their success. But the problem with all of those models is that they're inward looking. You know, you use the word generosity, but me giving a huge amount of money to my son, if I were to have that money, is kind of generosity, but it's kind of not really, because I'm still keeping it within the home. And so the generosity of Acts 2 is a kind of generosity, but it's keeping it within a very holy huddle. Real generosity is when you give without expecting ever to see anything in return. And that means the church, you know, that's God's generosity. The generosity of the incarnation is God offering us Jesus, you know, deep down knowing that the crucifixion is practically inevitable, because it's our allergic reaction to utter goodness. You know, that's real generosity when you risk everything and you lose everything. And that doesn't happen in Acts 2 communities, because they become like the Amish and the Benedictines. They often actually do very well. And doing well under that model can be as bad as doing badly. You know, our fear is that if we get into an Acts 2 community, you know, I'm just going to, again, this is easy as the visiting speaker to say things like this. We worry that we'll become too intense, that the marriage relationships will start to get a bit blurry because everyone gets to know each other far too well and it's too intimate, and, you know, things will break down, or we'll run out of money, or we'll be so into these long community meals no one will ever go to work, or, you know, 100 different things that can go wrong with community, or there'll be massive fallouts and jealousies. That does happen, but actually success can be as much of a problem as failure, because that whole notion of self-sufficiency, you know, Christians aren't called to be self-sufficient, they're called to be utterly dependent on God and mutually interdependent with one another. So, you know, there are problems even when it works. I just challenge the word generosity in that way, because I think it is, you know, the church, you know, classically, a classic old Anglican phrase from the 1940s, the church is the only institution that exists for those outside it. You know, it is fundamentally here for the life of the world. Genesis 12 is Abraham's call for Israel to be fundamentally, you know, through you all the nations of the world will find a blessing. Israel isn't for itself. The Jews aren't there just to serve themselves. They're there as a blessing to the whole world. The church should be the same, not just self-sufficient. And so, I mean, yeah, that's partly why I stressed several times in talking about commercial activity, how this brings us into face-to-face contact and dependence on people who aren't Christians, and we become better people as a result.
It's fair to say that you still ask your church every year to review their giving. Partly because that's part of being Christian, I still think, isn't it, that we give?
Absolutely, I do. No, I mean, I mentioned that it was, you know, even in the 1980s, that the congregational giving was an under-tapped resource. It still is. I wish my congregation gave more than they did. However, I've never been part of a congregation that gives more voluntary time. And in some ways, that's more dynamic. And then, you know, I did make the point about the fact that doing this stuff visibly and publicly through business, in fact, holds us more accountable as a community than the kind of, you know, church where a couple of major donors who've made their money in dodgy ways wash it by giving it to the church, and the church still feels good about its self-sufficiency. You know, so there, you know, there are. But yes, no, we have a Giving Sunday every year. And our giving has gone consistently up, although our major donors do have this habit of dying, which, you know, suddenly jumps in, you realise who's really been giving the money.
There you go. We're kind of come to an end. I think that word that has been cropping up through this our two talks here is that imagination. And my hope is that we go from this place with fresh imagination, not to become St. Martin's in the Field as if we could, but to imagine what it might be to be church in Shoebury, in South Church, in Grays, wherever it is that you might become come from this evening, in ways that may be engaging with commerce and business, maybe engaging with culture or compassion, or being a new, different, vibrant congregation. And so, last plug, if your church is not engaged with Heart Edge, both David and I found it really beneficial. We're hoping that our churches will find it more beneficial as we go forward to be part of this network. Do speak to Jonathan or Sam before you go about that. Sam, we're grateful that you've come out this evening to be with us, and Jonathan as well. Should we show our appreciation? And as Baptists, shall we share the grace with one another? May the grace